Hi, film fans. How are you doing today? I hope this finds you well. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Thanks for all the lovely messages as we celebrated our 350th birthday or episode in the company of Mr. James Cameron. Now, I did this thing last week and I posted about it because I say this so many times, I'm sorry if I repeat myself. But when I'm doing the interviews, I'm kind of so engrossed in them that I really like enjoying listening back to them once the wonderful Ben, who works on the show, has done his magic and taken out lots of my M's and U's and whatnot and put little bits of music. And I really enjoyed listening to James Cameron. It's quite interesting as well, because I think you can hear as the interview goes on that he sort of, not that he warms up, but he kind of just gets into it. And I love the kind of little bits that he gives away about the future Avatar films and his response to the Rose and Jack question. So yeah, I really appreciate people getting in touch and just congratulating us on what we've been able to do with the podcast so far. You know, and believe me, there is so much more that we can do and want to do with it. So we're going to keep doing that. Today, I'm over the moon to be joined by Guillermo del Toro and Alexandre Desplat to discuss their wonderful collaboration on Guillermo's take on Pinocchio, which is streaming now on Netflix. I've watched it 3 times now with Spike, and he's slightly addicted to it and keeps kind of, because it's there and he watches it over and over. Set against the backdrop of the emergence of fascism in Italy, this is a bittersweet tale of the challenges of the father-son relationship, which has a deeply personal feel to it, as you'll hear Guillermo talk about. And as I've already said, it's certainly got my 9-year-old and I talking about the many profound themes that the film raises. As you'd expect, Alexandre's score is magnificent. And we're going to begin with his cue, Pinocchio's Choice. Guillermo, how are you?
Very good. Waiting for the Frenchman in England. so many times at war.
Is this a regular thing for you? Is it you're used to it?
No, he's actually very punctual.
Last time I was lucky enough to speak to him, he was very punctual. So yeah, I blame technology.
I mean too.
Yeah. How are you today?
Very good. Very happy to be in London.
Congratulations, both on the film, but also the response that it's had as well. You must be very happy.
You know, some movies take 3 years and you hope for the best. Movies take more than 15 years. You pray for the best.
I watched it with my 9-year-old. We just couldn't take our eyes and our ears and our soul really from it. It was lovely because it really got us talking afterwards. We had some really beautiful conversations about, yay! Bonjour, monsieur.
Bonjour, Edith. How are you? Hey, Guillermo.
How are you, my friend? Yeah, that was the idea to hopefully spark conversation in families.
Yeah. So yeah. Beautiful. I was just saying, Alexander, I watched the first time I watched the film with my 9-year-old, and it was just as I do some with so many films, but not all films stir up a really beautiful conversation that's gone on as well. And it's really lovely hearing him talk about the film with other people. You know, have you seen? And it's so lovely. So congratulations to you both.
We're very happy.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned there, Guillermo, just in terms of, you know, this project has been something that you've been working on. It's been part of you for such a long time. But what stirred that initial interest and want to tell this story in your way and in this particular way?
Pinocchio was something I wanted to do since I was a kid, a child filmmaker. I started making films at age 7. And I always wanted to do a version of Pinocchio with clay animation or stop motion, because I thought it would be great to do. And of course, the abyss between my desires and my capabilities started to being broached as I aged and I got more possibilities. I think in my 20s, I was already interested, but I had the equipment. I had a stop motion and makeup effects company when I was in my 20s. And we were professionally doing commercials and I thought we could do it, but I had no story. I only knew that I wanted to make it not about obedience, but disobedience. And I wanted to make disobedience a virtue. And I wanted to show that you don't have to transform to be loved. That was it. Then, right after Devil's Backbone, I thought I could do Pinocchio during a time of war. And that would fit those other themes. But I ended up doing Pan's Labyrinth. And then, around that time, 2004, I discovered the drawing by Gris Grimley that designed the Pinocchio that you see basically on the film. And it all fell into place right around then.
Would you say that each project you've worked on along the way till you really kind of got into this film, almost you brought something along the way with you in terms of, or it guided you in a way, or it told you what you wanted to do or not want to do with this particular project?
I think that even my relationship with Alexander being in the stage it is, my own relationship to fatherhood being not that of a son, but that of a father. The fact that I lost my dad, the fact that my kids were old enough to tell me how I was doing, and the reviews were not stellar, you know, everything happened at the right time.
Yeah,
this movie has a lot of depth for me and a lot of biography because it comes from a very sort of reconciliation with not only fatherhood, but the idea of dying.
Yeah.
The idea of not being here permanently.
Alexander, can you remember the first conversation you had with Guillermo about it, about when talking about what it would be? And I mean, because there is so much music in this film. It's gorgeous. There's the song, and the way that the score just beautifully kind of dances in and out of the songs as well. And I mean, there's so much to talk about, but what was the first conversation that you had with Guillermo about it?
Thank you, Edith. Guillermo, he presented me the film as a musical, which I was actually dreaming of doing one day. If Guillermo's dreaming was dreaming of doing Pinocchio, I was dreaming of doing I don't know why my telephone is ringing. I'm sorry.
It's me, no.
Yeah. I've got an idea.
I'm going to tell you wrong answer, Alexander.
No, thank you.
Refinancing.
Sorry, I'm in a hotel room. It's the
butler.
Person.
It's fine.
They want to my room.
At the
room. I said no. Leave me alone. I'm with my friends here. So it started with the idea of a musical, and I dreamed of that for a long, long time, to be able to mix songs and score and interweave the theme or the motifs of the songs into the score. And it was, we were very lucky because, first of all, Guillermo loves music. He loves music in his films. He loves my music so far, and I'm very lucky. And we had fantastic singers, as you have heard. The cast is stellar and pristine. And that's where we started. And we have a great cast. We have a great little boy who can sing. We have a lot of music to write and songs which will be the pillars of the film, you know, which will explain step by step where we are, what the characters are, and take us through the film.
Alexander and I, we met physically in person during Rise of the Guardians, the animated movie I co-produced at DreamWorks.
Love that film.
And he created such an incredible score, and we talked in a sushi restaurant. And I said to him, I was talking about Shape of Water with him, and said how much I loved his music. I had spoken or sent my good wishes to Alexander before, when the Queen, I believe, was in competition with Pan's Labyrinth. And I spoke to his agent. I said, please tell Alexander that if anyone wins other than him, I'll be angry. I think that Alexander embodies what I think music for film is. Mm-hmm. I think this bullshit about music and film being imperceptible, I think that's a fallacy. If you are in favor of that, don't use music. Mm. And then it will be imperceptible. I think that a score on film is indivisible, which is a very different word, indivisible from the film. And if done right, which Alexander does every time, it becomes the soul of the film talking. And in the case of Pinocchio, that had to seamlessly bond the songs and the score into one identity. And that's really, really hard.
What came first, the songs, the score, or did you work on them kind of in parallel, or did one inform the other? Or
no, we started with drafts of the lyrics by Guillermo and Patrick, and then Guillermo by himself, and I started writing the songs because they had to be animated, and that, as you know, takes ages. So we had to write the songs first while the movie was still being in process and being made, and I think it took maybe 2 years before I could write a score or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. But fortunately, when we stumbled upon the lullaby, my son, that we immediately knew that theme was going to become part of the vocabulary of Geppetto Carlo Pinocchio. Mm. Because one way to evoke Carlo while Pinocchio is alive is by using the phrases of my song in the score.
My son, you are my shining sun, my moon, my stars, my clear blue daylight sky. And if you looked at me today, my heart would heal so far. And if you help me right away, I'd be complete at last, at last. You are my favorite, favorite thing, better than sunset, better than spring. You bring me joy, you make me sing, in the morning and the evening too. Everything to me, and I love you.
That beautiful opening cue, which has that, it's such an important piece of music because, it's the opening, it's almost kind of the welcoming, the musical welcoming into the film. And it's Carlo's story, it's Geppetto, it's also where we start in the film in terms of the kind of sadness in a way of the narrative. But it's not, it can't have that much sadness to it musically. It's so delicate in terms of how you kind of have to sort of dance around that. Was that one of the first things that you kind of created to, you know, to help with tonally for the rest of the film? Because
yes,
it's such a beautiful piece of music.
Yes, I wanted to find once the songs were written, I wanted to find Carlo Pinocchio's theme, which is the same character, obviously.
Yeah.
And we share with Guillermo this joyous melancholy, I think, in our life and in our work. And I think that theme is really the crystallization of that joyous melancholy. Or yeah, I can't find other terms than these two words, you know, this oxymoron. Yeah. Because there's sadness, but it has to be a deep sadness, something that everybody can understand, can share. We've all lost someone in our lives, and there's something that has to be instilled from the beginning, the innocence of the child, the loss of the child, and how at the same time a new boy will bring joy and will bring hope. And so it's all these emotions, which are very mm-hmm. complex, that we had to focus on putting together in this main theme that opens the film.
Of how that theme is arrived at is every session of the scoring starts early in the morning. I walk or take a cab to Alexander's studio in Paris, and he plays pieces for me on the piano, and then like a maitre d' in a restaurant says, "That's it, you have to leave." And then I leave and I see him the next day, and that day he had prepared for me four appetizers, and he played all four appetizers in the piano. And this is the one I teared up to because the best way to represent it is it has to be a eulogy of something beautiful. It carries with it the impossible beauty of something beyond natural, and at the same time, the sense that you already lost it. And that is the simplicity the melody has to have, and the profundity it has to evoke.
And then I guess from that point as well, you say, you know, you're creating it on the piano, but then knowing what the right instrumentation is for the different characters, for the different cues, for the different moments that come in. There's lovely kind of sort of wisps of woodwind, and I love the little bit where Ewan's character, where Cricket's just about to sing "My Dear Father," and that beautiful guitar just before, you know, he's kind of almost sort of getting himself ready, and then it stops. Brilliant. There's lovely kind of character unveiling through the instrumentation that you've used as well, and emotion in that as well.
Yeah, but I suggested to Guillermo, and he was happy with this idea to use only wood instruments for the score. And it creates a very, you know, intimate and special sound to the film, mixed with all the great sound effects that we have everywhere. And there's a proximity with this instrument. They're not loud. They're not, you know, they don't show off. They're just, yeah, they create a kind of jewel case for the characters to.
Yeah.
And you know, what I love to do is actually when I write music for films, it's to follow the characters. That's what I love. And the characters are so deep in the layers, the way the characters are written, and the storyline is so deep that the music just embraces that route, you know. I just follow what they're doing.
With regards to the voices, I mean, the casting is brilliant. David Bradley is an inspired piece of casting for Geppetto. I mean, he's one of those actors that we've watched, you know, over the years in so many things. But there's something just about his voice, is, you know, acting just with his voice sort of thing. And the the range of it is wonderful. Yeah. Do you mind talking just a little bit about the casting, please?
Well, David and I had done two entire series before Pinocchio. He was one of my stars in The Strain for FX Network. And he was one of the stars of Trollhunters, Tales of Arcadia. And I realized that his voice had this impossible range, and within one line he can go into an arpeggio and a basso profondo, and it kind of cracks. So he can go and say, "I told you, you would go to," you know, it goes in, it's incredible. I used to imitate him constantly, but at the same time, I think he is one of the largely unrecognized great actors. He comes from classical training in British theater. Mm-hmm. He is a man of capable of incredible subtlety with his voice. And I knew he would deliver a great Geppetto. Every voice I wanted to carry a world with it. So Christoph Waltz immediately has this Kurt Weill Wagnerian, bombastic, seductive, brutal, intimidate, all of it. And Ewan McGregor, I think, has one of the most noble, heartbreaking voices I've ever heard. Gregory Mann, we had to find him amongst hundreds of children, which is always the case in child casting.
Yeah.
You know, I think that you're Tilda Swinton, I wrote it for her.
Oh.
Because she is the only supernatural voice I know exists in the world, you know. And somebody like Bern Gorman, whom I worked with in Pacific Rim and Crimson Peak, is a known entity. Ron Perlman, is a known quantity for me. And the inspired occurrence was Cate Blanchett as the monkey. Because it sounds like a great joke, but she actually makes that character work. It's not a one-note sidekick or a joke. She gives it tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it happened, it was so much fun because we would be recording in the ADR stage in London, the monkey, and I would leave the booth, and Todd Field was coming in to record her as Tar. So she would go from the monkey to Tar within the space of one session.
That's amazing. I was lucky enough to chat to her last week about it, and it was amazing. And it's just that, you know, these two films are a great example of how amazing she is, you know. And it's kind of like, literally within a breath, she can go from one to the other. Phenomenal.
The way she approached it was beautiful because she said, "I don't want to do a sampler of sounds."
Yeah.
She said, "I want to do it scene by scene."
Yeah.
And you please tell me what the monkey is thinking or feeling, because I don't want to just do noises. Yeah. I want to sort of get, and I do believe it sounds irrationally funny, but she made the performance deep.
Yeah. Those performances, Alexander, when you're, you know, in terms of just having voice, how does that inspire you? You know, in terms of there's not, you know, you've obviously there's animation. Is it the same for you in terms of your taking the inspiration from the performance as a whole, or talk to me a little bit about having those performances, whether it's solely voice, is it finding
when you have these talents, you just have to dance with them. You just have to dance with them to be. No, it's true. You and of course, in a film like Pinocchio, there's so much music, so much going on. You know, you have to write hours of music, but you can hook yourself to the actors and they just, you know, take you like in a tango. They take you around because they give so much energy, so many different emotions. They just have to follow what they're doing. It's easy somehow, you know what I mean? Because they're there, because they're so good. If the performances were not as good, I would be pushing with the music to make it more. You don't have to do that. You just have to be yourself with them and dance with them. It's yeah.
There was a lovely thing that you said at one of the many acceptance speeches that you've made so far, Guillermo, for the film. Congratulations. Was that about animation and about it not being for kids? And I totally agree with you. I think sometimes animation can, you know, and with the right film, can say so much more. It can kind of, you know, like I was saying earlier about being able to sit with a 9-year-old and find things to talk about that no other kind of production could allow, kind of to stir up those questions and those emotions and those connections with, whether it be a storyline, a character, an emotion, and a moment within a film. For you, what does animation give you the opportunity to do as a storyteller?
Well, without any hyperbole, it really is a superb feat of creation for the entire team.
Yeah.
You never feel more like a carnival than in animation because you learn to depend on each other. It's an acrobatic feat because in real life, when you direct, you're trying to line up the vectors so that an accident happens in front of the lens and you capture life. In animation, you're not only organizing the vectors, you're creating every single piece of motion. There is no wind to move the protagonist's hair. Unless there is a wire on a sculpted piece of hair. Mm. There is no flap of a cape when somebody turns, unless you wired that cape to turn and be animated frame by frame. So the immense creative act is enormous and is such a powerful medium that it's a shame that we wasted by infantilizing it voluntarily as an industry into being a domesticated medium. And disguise him as a genre for kids. It really is shameful. And the animation has given us some of the most powerful images in the history of cinema. And it's a testament to movies like The Red Turtle, which I think is a masterpiece. Movies like I Lost My Body, and movies like Watership Down. These are pinnacles of animation that show how adult and profound it can be. And Pinocchio wanted to belong in the same category. That's why nobody wanted to do it.
Yeah.
That's why everybody turned it down, because they would say, is it for kids? And I would say, no, but kids can watch it if their parents talk to them, because it will provoke questions. Most people are looking for a babysitter movie, a movie that they can turn on and leave their kids in front of the TV and not talk to them for 2 hours. This is not that movie. This movie is a very personal and very profound meditation about how brief life is, how imperfect fathers and imperfect sons can find reconciliation and forgiveness, and how disobedience is an urgent virtue. So I think animation is, as particularly stop motion, is analog to live action in that it is using real sets, real props, real wardrobe, linear movement in time and space, and real cinematography, etc. But the way we interact with a puppet as an audience and as a creator is more profound. I think it's an act of will to make it move, and it's an act of empathy to believe that it's alive. And an audience watches a puppet enraptured.
I love how it's my introduction to Spike, my son, to your work. So I can't wait to kind of, it's the gateway for him now, for when, you know, when he's old enough to watch whatever films it is of us kind of going down the rabbit hole of Guillermo's films, which is, it's an absolute joy to think about, to kind of get the chance to watch them with him. It's what? Brilliant. It's so exciting.
And I must say that once they've seen it once, the kids, and I've seen many kids around, then they can watch it by themselves, and they'll watch it and they listen to the score on and on, because they get completely hooked by the film.
Yes. And now he can watch Hellboy 1, Hellboy 2, Pacific Rim. He's ready for Pacific Rim.
Yeah, where should we start, do you think? Where should I send him?
I think those three, I think Alexander and I unfortunately made The Shape of Water requires a couple of...
Yeah, maybe a few years.
Decades, yeah.
But it's so exciting. Before we run out of time, there was one thing that I wanted to ask you, was with regards to film and music. You know, I've been lucky enough to have Alexander on the podcast before, and it's been so great to celebrate his work. But for you as a storyteller, can you remember the moment as a film fan where stories really started to connect with you, that you recognized the importance of that relationship between the moving image and music?
It's incredibly easy, because the first record I paid for and owned was Score. The first two records I bought were The Godfather and Jaws. Oh. Because back then, when I was young, I depended on the records to remember the movies. You couldn't play them back on VHS or on demand or nothing. The only way you could do is you had the poster, you play the record, you turn off the lights and imagine the movie. You remembered the movie, which is a beautiful way of owning it and becoming one with it. I think that some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard is score music. And I think the key to it is emotion, and to encompass the whole film. It is not separate from film. It oxygenates the film. And Alexander's does it.
And he's playing it for you now, you know, in the background. He's got a girl in the background.
No, it's funny because, you know, I have two idols, which is Nino Rota and John Williams.
Yes.
And I didn't know that they were the two records that Guillermo had bought. No, I didn't know. Yeah. And I was just listening to Casanova this morning. Casanova.
Oh, that's one of the great forgotten Fellinis and one of the great scores.
That goes back to what you were saying at Stargame about that thing of kind of you can't separate the two. So, you know, in terms of that's a great example of where the need for each other is so important, that when you listen to one, you can see the other. You know, that kind of idea of like it's there, it's in there already. That's beautiful.
It is funny, because one of the capital offenses of filmmaking is when you temp your movie with score from Needle Drops.
Yeah.
And when by accident Alexander gets sent a file with a temp score, he calls me and says, what is this abomination? It doesn't matter what it is, because it is an intruder at your home. It is like somebody broke into your home. It is not natural. It doesn't belong. If you get used to it, it's a crime, you know? And I think that one of the things I most admire about Alexander is that we talk about the score many, many, many times before he plays a note or claims to know a note. Mm. He doesn't say, I'm thinking about something like this. he wants to see the movie. He wants to talk about the movie. He wants to see the dailies. He wants to see the designs. And one morning, he plays something and you go, it's like seeing a plant coming out of the ground. And you go, ah, the movie. Mm. Isn't that beautiful?
How do you know when you've hit something, Alexander? How do you know when you've got something that you want to share with Gilmore? What is it that you...
I cry.
Is it a feeling? Do you feel it? Do you feel, go, yeah, that's... How do you know?
You know, I write sketches on notebooks like this one, bigger ones. This one is a smaller draft. I'm traveling, but I write, you know, I feel a whole notebook of bar, little bars, little motifs, things, and I never use them usually. It's just the way I kind of put my ideas together. And one day I think, I think this is right. I can feel that it is, I'm almost hearing the movie without watching it. I can hear it. And many times, actually, I play the movie in my studio from a distance. I'm not watching the screen. I'm just hearing the dialogue or the sounds. And I know that I think I'm there. I'm around where I should be. But before I can play it together, I need to expand a bit, you know, the melody and the things that it has some shape. And the second moment is when he comes into my studio, comes down the stairs, come up on the door. And then I know if I'm right or wrong before even playing it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Because what I do is to create bridges with the director. And it's his vision that comes through my body, my brain. And I try to re-express that into music. So by having the physical contact, it's a big difference than just being on the phone with a Zoom or it's very strange.
And writing the songs, it was really great because I've been told I'm no lyricist twice. once by Paul Williams, which is quite an authority, and the second time in a really un-French way by Alexander. We need help. But the notion, I remember being in his studio next to the piano, and he said, so what is the line that would define this song? And I would say, well, everything is new to him. And he says, okay, that's good. Let's write it down. Everything is new to me.
Yeah.
And then he said, and how would it go? And I said, well, he would say, what do you call this? And I said, let's do it, but repeat it twice. What do you call it? Call it.
Hmm.
See, and then he started playing, what do you call it? Call it. And then what do you do with it? Smash, right? And then we started building that way. And then him and Katz would make a song out of those sketches. But to me, learning from Alexander about what makes a song and not a poem and not a piece of prose, it was really interesting. And he said, it doesn't have to rhyme, which to me, I was writing all rhyming stuff. It doesn't have to rhyme. It just has to have a certain rhythm. You know, I learned so much that I will never do it again.
I was hoping you were going to say you're writing an album.
No. I know I can hopefully one day sketch another lyrics for one more song or two, but never, I have no delusions. But it was a really educational thing.
Amazing. Listen, I could talk to you all day about this. It is such a joy to get to talk to you about this beautiful relationship that you have together and how we get to, you know, enjoy the virtues of that. It's wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, Gilmore. It's wonderful to meet you and lovely to see you again, Alexander. Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
All the things my eyes can see. Everything is new to me.
What do you call it? Call it?
Hammer.
What to do with it? With it?
You tap, you smash, you shatter.
Love it. I love it. Everything is new to me.
From Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, that's Everything Is New to Me by Alexander Desplat, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the director and his composer. My huge thanks to Guillermo and Alexander for taking the time to talk to me. Pinocchio is screening in a few selected cinemas, so seek it out if you can. But as I said, it's also available now on Netflix. I had the most extraordinary experience last week. I was invited to host an event at Abbey Road Studios with the most talented orchestra, some of which featured players who recorded the score for it. And then I hosted a Q&A afterwards with Alexander Desplat, with Guillermo del Toro, and also with Mark Gustafsson, who's the other director on the film and comes from this incredible background of stop motion animation. So the three of us sat and had the most wonderful conversation about the film, following just the score being played. It wasn't played to the film, it was just the music in the room with a small audience. It was amazing. If that's going to be widely available, I'll let you know, because if you're a fan of the film, fan of the score, fan of Guillermo's, fan of Alexander's, then you need to hear the conversation. It was absolutely gorgeous. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And there is plenty to enjoy on our YouTube channel too. So please do subscribe when you get a moment. I am just waiting on my Wi-Fi. It's like I have to pedal to get this thing to work to upload the Damien Chazelle, but it is on the way, I promise. Next up, we have another bonus episode for you, and I'm really proud of this episode, actually, because this is a film that has connected on so many levels, and a film from a story that is almost 100 years old. The book, anyway, is almost 100 years old. And the book was All Quiet on the Western Front. It was adapted by Edward Berger, and it's been directed by him too, and the score has been done by Volker Bertelmann, who's previously appeared on the podcast with his sometime composing companion. But it was great to get Edward and Volker together to talk about this brilliant film, All Quiet on the Western Front, which, if I can, encourage you to watch on Netflix before listening to the next episode of the podcast, because it's kind of quite nice where you get the chance to watch the film before we go into much detail about it. So, Edward Berger, Volker Bertelmann, our next guest on Soundtracking. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.